Good evening and welcome to the Spring 2015 Green Living Seminar Series at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. Each spring semester, we invite a series of experts to campus to present on various aspects of sustainability. This semester, our topic is issues in climate change. We have speakers on policy, energy, nature conservation, and science, all as they apply to climate change. Tonight's speaker is Lauren Garrity of the Berkshire Regional Planning Commission. Ms. Garrity has been in the regional planning field for more than 15 years, focusing on planning for the natural world. She is the author of the Massachusetts Buffer Manual, a statewide guide for lakefront and riverfront property owners. Over the years, she has worked with several Berkshire County municipalities on open space and recreation planning, and served as the agency's lead in the developing the resource, conservation, and recreation section of Sustainable Berkshires, the initiative that culminated in a countywide master plan. Lauren was also a contributing editor to the energy and climate section of Sustainable Berkshires. Her current projects include working on Community Bicycle Path Project in North Adams and Lee. Lauren holds a Master of Science degree in Resource Management and Administration from Antioch, New England, and is an alumnus of NCLA, formerly North Adams State College. Tonight's lecture will last about 45 minutes, and there will be about 15 minutes for questions and answers after the lecture. Lauren's lecture is entitled Climate Change Presents Challenges to Berkshire Municipalities. Let's welcome Lauren Garrity.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you for having me. I know that you've had a series over the last few weeks, and we're going to have a little bit in the front to talk about for those who are in the audience or seeing this on the web or have not been to other talks. We're going to have a quick background about climate change and what some of the impacts might be to our region, the Berkshire region. And then we're going to focus tonight mostly on municipalities. How is climate change going to, how is it affecting municipalities now, meaning the government, and how are they going to have to adjust in the future? So it's basically what's it doing to our conditions here in the Berkshires now, and then how will they have to adjust in the future? So I think everybody in the room understands that we have higher temperatures. We have a lot of statistics from a lot of scientists telling us a lot of different things. So we've got temperature increases. We have a warmer climate coming on. Our winters are going to, you'd never know now, but our winters are going to be warmer faster than our summers. Warmer air masses because of our warmer seasons sometimes will bring us a change in our weather patterns. Our weather patterns might be more unpredictable and more extreme. We've been seeing that a little bit here. We're going to have extreme heat days more often than we have now. The urban areas like Albany, Springfield, Boston, New York City, they're going to be warmer faster because they have a very urban core and they're like a heat island. Here in the Berkshires, we're a little higher in elevation, so we're buffered from that. But we will have hotter days. They'll be more often, and we might have spates of days that'll be longer. So that basically is going to be our setup for temperature and weather in the next decades. Storm changes. We're going to talk a lot about today about precipitation and how that change is going to affect our municipalities and how they work. So I don't know how much you've had recently, but we do know that the stream gauges are telling us that we have a clear increase in precipitation over the years. We've had an increase from 1940 until today, and a lot of the data in the Northeast is showing us that we've had sort of a stepped increase or a severe increase from 1970 until today. We also have these things are happening even though in New England much of our forest has returned. We had a lot of our forests were cleared for agriculture and development. A lot of those have come back, and yet we're still seeing increase in precipitation and stream flow even though the forest has come back. So that's telling us something's a little askew here in the next, in these past decades and in the next decades. Recurrence intervals are things we hear about that 100-year storm. And we hear this a lot about it in the papers when we have storms in our area. So a lot of engineers design certain infrastructure according to recurrence intervals. Many things, many of our infrastructure is looking at 10-year or 25-year recurrent intervals. So that means I'm going to have a severe storm or the storm event that I'm designing for, we would expect it to come back every once every 10 years once every 25 years. It's all statistics, but we do have, it shows a pattern. And we see that the 100-year storm is now coming in half the time. So that's what the data is telling us over our last century or so. So we take that, and we can see this is a picture of the Housatonic River. We see the river meandering through open fields over on the left-hand side, and we can see when it floods, this is what it looks like when it floods. So when it kind of gives you an idea of what flooding occurs along a riverway. So we're out there, and all that area that's dark brown because of flooding has a lot more sediment in it, so a lot of the water quality is impacted as well. That's just an idea of here's a river normally in its normal flow pattern, and here's a flow over on the right-hand side. So we're going to have more rain. When the rain comes, it's going to be slightly skewed than when it is now. We're going to have a little bit more ice storms. We're going to have, because our winters are getting just those few degrees warmer, we're going to have less snow, and we'll have more rain events. We might have more ice storms like we had a couple of years ago. So we're going to have more what the scientists are calling rain on snow or rain on ice. And a lot of that, when it rains in the summer, a lot of that rain can be soaked up by the soils. When the ground is frozen in the winter, when we have snowpack, that's just going to run off right into the stream. So we have a different pattern of runoff different times of the year. So things are going to be changing in our streams, and they're going to be changing in our roadways and in our culverts and our storm drain systems. On the flip side, there could be more evaporation. So we have a couple of years ago, we had some heat spells, and some of our reservoirs were dwindled down because of, number one, we had less rain. Number two, the higher temperatures gives us a lot more evaporation. So we could see, we haven't seen it yet in New England, other parts of the country have seen it, we could actually see some cycles in the summer of drought. We haven't really prepared for that because we in New England are pretty lucky. We're pretty water rich. But it's something to think about and something we have to plan for in the future. Disasters. We hear a lot about disaster declarations. And looking back into the FEMA records, we see that in the years from 2000 to 2015, we've had more disasters declared than we did in the entire 50 years. So some of that could be because we are calling those disasters a little bit sooner, but it does show a pattern that we have more disasters than we did in the previous years. We did have some of the events we have in Berkshire County, 2005, 6, 10, 8, 11, and 12. These are where we also had very damaging storm events. We had flooding. We had property damage. We had power outages. We had road damages. So these are really severe storms that aren't just flooding in the stream in the backyard. These are what are impacting our municipalities. Tropical Storm Irene came by in 2011. This is sort of the gold standard. Northern Berkshire County and Franklin County, the Deerfield watershed, were really heavily impacted by heavy rains. They're still doing all the math, and they're still telling us they're not sure of the recurrence event, but they're calling this stream, this event, at least 100-year storm in Williamstown, and anywhere between 100 and a 500-year storm over in the Deerfield Valley. And these are pictures, if anybody's seen the chutes in Adams and North Adams, and we talked about it earlier, those chutes usually have a trickle of water in them, or they have very low flows in them. And we see in these pictures here from my Berkshires, the chutes were almost full. So we see that this is a very, very intense storm, the likes of which we're not used to. Luckily, the chutes held up, and they did their job, but this is something we very, very seldom see. This is pictures up in the town of Florida along Route 2. So this is somewhere between 100 and 500-year storm event. Not only was there severe flooding, this is the Cold River. You see, let's see if I can use this pointer. This is the river here. It came up, and it just ate away at this bank. And this is a guardrail. And it's just the bank has just subsided and collapsed absolutely in. The river couldn't get through the bridge, because the bridge was a constriction. So it came, and it just eroded away at that bank. So Route 2 was closed for quite a while. On top of that, so we had the river eating away at bridges and roadways and the sides of roads. We also have up here in the top one, if you can see, a huge slope has just come down across the road. So the road is here. Here's the river. Here's the road. And the road is absolutely buried in a landslide. We don't see landslides all that often. But because the amount of rain, the intensity of the rain, the soils could not hang on anymore, and they came down the steep slopes that go along the roadway. So this had a double whammy. It had the flooding river, and it had a landslide. We don't see those often. We might see these more often as time goes by because of our changing precipitation. Very expensive. This is a state road, so this did not cost any municipality a lot of money. We all taxpayers had to pay for that. If that was a local road, that probably would be closed for a couple of years. But because it's a major artery and a major roadway for Northern County to link Boston and Williamstown, that was replaced faster, but it took a lot of money, as you can see. So we need to think about these storm events. How are they coming more often, and how does that impact the municipality? 2008, we had the ice storm, another gold standard. The ice storm hit most of Massachusetts. It also hit New York, New Hampshire, Vermont. This ice storm, we had some residents without power for over 2 weeks. We had the National Guard mobilized, which very seldom occurs in Massachusetts. Usually it's more intense, dense areas, but this was statewide. All of the utilities were affected, and because it was so widespread, the utilities couldn't keep up. They had to import crews from elsewhere, from different states. They came from all over the East Coast, Pennsylvania, North Carolina. They had to import them in to help these folks get the power lines back up and running. Although we think of Irene as sort of the bigger one because we see the floods, this was actually more costly. This was a more costly storm event, $55 million in FEMA and state money to get everything up and running again. And that is state money, and that's to help everyone get going again. That's to help the DPW crews get the ice off of the roadways, to get the branches off the roadways. That, on top of that, utilities spent billions of dollars getting their infrastructure back up and running. They had to redo all the lines. They had to put poles back up. That money, because utilities are private, will be funded by ratepayers like you and I. So we are going to still be paying the utility companies for the cost that they had to pay to clean up that storm. So all those crews from North Carolina and from Pennsylvania that the utilities paid for, you and I will be paying for somewhere over the next decade or so, because they're going to pass that cost on to the ratepayers. Just an idea of what the cost was. The town of Princeton, it's a medium-sized town out in central Mass. They had $3.8 million, that should be $1 million, in damages, and that's more than their annual budget. So when we have an event of this scale, the municipality does not know how to bounce back. So municipalities, there's basically four regions we're going to talk about tonight. Four things are the infrastructure, the stormwater, the roadways, the things you think about, the flooding. DPWs are out there. Like right now with the frozen pipes, the DPWs out there fixing all the water mains that are broken. Strains on first responders and public health departments. Something we don't think about. We don't think about the fact that the volunteer fire department, the ambulance, the police are out there when roadways are closed. They have to evacuate people. So we're going to talk about that a little bit more and the impact on them from climate change. Balancing these needs, fiscal reality. Our communities are getting less state aid than they have in the past. Increases in energy and personnel and all the things that go on. The increases of running government go up every year. They're getting less money from the state. How do they deal with the stuff that they're not used to? And lastly, zoning. People say, well, can we zone better? And we can. We'll talk about that just a little bit at the end. Talked about flooding. So, flooding. Most of our storm drain system. So think of our roadways and you see a grate along the road. It's a storm drain system, and it carries the flow, goes off the road, goes in the storm drain, gets piped, goes into the nearest stream, the nearest wetland, wherever they can pipe it. Same thing, we have wastewater and we have sewer underlines. Under the ground for the most part, under our roadways a lot, going across our streams. Infrastructure in Western Massachusetts was largely put there 100 years ago. So most of the pipes under the ground right now that our DPWs are facing, most of them are 100 years old, some are more. Even young ones are decades old. Many are clay pipes, and they're breaking. We also have a lot of inflow of groundwater into the pipes. So these decades-old infrastructures under the ground, you can't see them. You can't tell when they're breaking until they're broke, like now when we see them fixing the water mains. So number one, very aged infrastructure. Number two, undersized culverts and bridges. We're talking about more floods, bigger floods. The fact is, those bridges, those roadways, are just like the storm drain system. Decades old, they're not large enough to handle the newer, higher flows that we have. Consequently, we have more flooding. More flooding means the DPW is out there more often. We see more road washouts. So we have all this aged infrastructure under the ground, and then we have our culverts and bridges that are undersized. So here we see, this is a roadway. You can see the yellow line. The storm came through. There was a culvert here. It just wiped out the culvert. The culvert's downstream. The road is gone. This is going to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to fix. And that's just one crossing in one town. And that wasn't even Irene. Up here, I don't know if you can see it, here's a roadway. Here's a culvert. And all this water is backed up behind it. That's because this culvert is undersized. This water, there's too much water, can't fit through the pipe. Simple as that. So now you have more flooding upstream, which means it might go out. Sometimes it might come back and it might start to erode along the roadway and start to undercut the road. So not only do we have problems here at the crossing itself, we might have problems 500 feet up the road because the stream has undercut the roadway. So this is some of the things that DPWs are facing. DPWs, so something like this, say it started to undercut the road. All right, well, we got some gravel, we have riprap, we'll go out. I got my guys, we go out. We'll just put more fill, store up that road, put up more riprap, off we go. And because this happens so often, it's sort of routine for them. They buy a bunch of gravel, they get the crews out, and they do 4 or 5 roads all the time every year. This is kind of how they work. Because they've already got the material, they don't have to, you know, hire somebody to do it. It's easiest if I just send my guys out and put some more fill and riprap, off we go. So this is sort of routine. So road crossings. Hundreds of road crossings in Berkshire County. And we're just Berkshire County. And we don't even have a lot of roads. We have 2,500 road crossings, documented road crossings. So almost 800 have been assessed visually to see if they are up to snuff. They are looked to make sure that they're intact. They are looked at to see if they are constricted. So in other words, like we saw in the previous, there's a stream channel going along the way. There's a road crossing with a bridge. Does the stream have to squeeze in through this bridge and then go back out into its bank? So constricted means that water has to be constricted and then go back out into its bank. Of those 700, almost 500, 450 are constricted. Severe are the ones in red. A severe constriction means likely extra flooding all the time. It might be more bank erosion, which impacts our water quality. So we have these. We know that these are areas prone to flooding. We know they're constricted. We know they're a problem. We know they're undersized. No budget. Besides that, and it's hard to see on this map, it's way up here. Oh, I did it. Purple. Flooding areas Our agency works with municipalities to create hazard mitigation plans that document where the bad guys are, the really chronic flooded areas. It's hard to see, but you can see besides constricted culverts, we also have flooded areas in purple throughout the county. Most of them are in South County. So these are areas that we already know are a problem, and there's a lot of them. This is another picture. Dirt roads, gravel roads. We have a lot of these in our smaller communities. They're more prone to being washed out. And this one over on the top. Here's the culvert. The culvert, the stream that came through here, blew out the culvert and then blew out the road downhill. So that's just one simple road in one town in one storm event. Down here, we can see a bridge that has very obvious stress. And you can see here's the bank, and here's the bank, and here's a constriction. Because the water, when it's going full force in a storm event, can't get through this small constriction. So besides the constrictions of culverts, we have bridges, which are just bigger things with bigger infrastructure. 21 in the county are known to be deficient. Right now, there's very little money to actually fix them. The Patrick administration noted that a couple of years ago and brought that to the forefront and brought money to say, we got to fix these bridges. We need to do this. And then I'm not sure what happened there, but we're still suffering by the fact that we have more deficient bridges. We don't have enough money to fix those. Besides roadways, many of our water and our sewer lines go along roads or under roads, or many of them actually cross bridges. There's pipes that go right across the bottom of a bridge. So they're also very vulnerable to flooding, because if the flood wipes out the bridge or begins to crumble with the bridge, there goes the water and sewer line. You might lose water for drinking, water to your residents. You also might have sewage spilling into that stream. So there's a lot of issues with erosion and storms and in rivers getting out of their channels. Landfills, surprisingly. Many of our historic landfills are along riverways and our floodplains. So if we have a river that is beginning to become unstable and starts to eat away at its banks, it could actually start to cut into the landfill and garbage can start to enter. Garbage and leaching can actually go into the stream. So that's another issue that we have just because of flooding and a lot of erosion. There's been some studies in New Hampshire done by a bunch of scientists, and they started to look at, we know that we have problems with flooding. We know we have culverts undersized. It's sort of a known thing. They said, let's quantify that. Let's really go in there and assess every single culvert, assess the size, and look at the watershed, and look at the stream data, and say, hey, how bad is this thing? Let's quantify it. So it's a very small watershed. It's right here. Oops. It's the Oyster River watershed. Has a lot of development, suburbia, up in New Hampshire. The Hoosick watershed, think of North County and the Hoosick watershed. In Berkshire County is about 120,000 acres. This is only 19,000 acres, so it's a small watershed. But they looked at the culverts in that entire watershed. They went out and examined them all, measured them all, and then ran models of flood events. They found that one-third of the culverts in that watershed are undersized. Most of these were in high gradient, low order streams. These are the smaller streams that we think about. So when you're talking about stream gradients, you start out in high stream gradients, like in mountainsides, and it kind of flows downstream, and it joins a bigger stream and a bigger stream until it gets to a river. These are in smaller streams. They found that most of the problems were in the smaller streams. That can correlate somewhat to Berkshire County, because we have a lot of small streams in our mountain areas. So we want to look at that and say, ooh, this is probably what could be occurring here. On top of that, 5% of the culverts are undersized for something that's called TP40. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. But that's an engineering standard. So even back when these were put in the ground, and they were probably put in the ground decades ago, and perhaps some of them 100 years ago, even sizing it at that time, they were undersized. So some of these were designed incorrectly at the time. 5% may not seem like a lot, but when we start adding up and thinking that just replacing a culvert costs thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of dollars, that means a lot to a municipality. Did the same thing at Keene, and they were said somewhere between 30 to 80% were undersized for the city of Keene. So we talked about, storm drain systems I talked about are those drain systems that help our roadways shed water when it rains. And this is Pittsfield, and there's chronic areas all across Berkshire County that when it rains, these underground systems, they just can't handle it. They're overwhelmed. Part of that is because of our precipitation changes. We're getting more rain, more severe storms. Also, it's impervious area. We've developed areas. So because that area, this area is all built up. It's got parking lots. It's got supermarkets in buildings and pharmacies. This area in Pittsfield now, instead of having impervious area and soils to soak up that water, it's all impervious. And as soon as it rains, that goes right into the storm drain. So there's no way for it to infiltrate, and it just overwhelms our storm drain systems. So that was happening with development on a good day, and now we have climate change on top of that. Sometimes when storm drain systems are overwhelmed, they can back up and they can mingle with sewer lines. And now all of a sudden the water that's headed in a sewer line to the treatment plant is overwhelmed. A sewer line typically is only handling sewer. And it's only waste, and it goes from municipalities, from businesses, residents, goes to the treatment plant, gets treated, and get discharged into the river. Once we start having huge storm problems, we have storm water overwhelming the sewer system. And now all of a sudden, there's a lot of water going to the treatment plant. It's diluted because it's storm water runoff, and it's not as intensely polluted like the sewer water is, but there's a lot more of it. So now all of a sudden the treatment plant is overwhelmed. It can't handle the volume. And sometimes that gets put into the river, and now we're seeing raw sewage go into the river instead of treated water going in the river. Other areas that sewer water could back up into the storm drain that's directed, that typically would go right into the river. Doesn't need to be treated. It's just runoff from parking lots and from roadways. So it isn't typically treated at all. Now all of a sudden the sewer drain is overwhelmed. It leaks out into the storm drain, and now you've got raw sewage going into the river from storm drains. So now you have some communities that are out of compliance with permits. Hoosac Water Quality District is an example of that. They can't handle the intense storms, and they're suffering with capacity because they're at capacity almost already, and then these storm events come and overwhelm them. So that's one example of all these things happening, and municipalities are struggling to keep up with this. Many of our municipalities own dams. You don't think of it, but anybody with a surface water reservoir has a dam. That's how the water is held there. And many of our dams, like our infrastructure, are decades old or 150 year old. So they're also aged, and they're showing signs of wear and tear. So on a good day, they're struggling to maintain those dams. Now we have more floods, and now those dams are being strained because now the reservoirs or the stream or the river that they're impounding is overwhelming them. So now we have a dam maintenance issue. Very expensive, hard to fix, very expensive to maintain. We have 226 dams in the county, 43 owned by municipalities. 8 of them are in poor condition. That's 8 dams owned by municipalities. We have other dams that are in poor condition owned by businesses, but that's just our municipalities. Of those 8, 2 are in poor condition are high hazard dams. High hazard dams are those that are a certain size, that if they fail, They will almost certainly cause damage, property damage, or injury or loss of human life. So, two of the poor condition are high hazard dams. If they fail, we have some issues. So, high cost of maintaining them. Barriers. Okay. Engineers have certain sets of data that they use to figure out the size of a culvert, figure out the size of a dam. Right now, the engineers, I'm going to talk about the bottom one, the engineers are often using outdated data. We're going to get that in a minute. So we have some engineering standards that are a drawback. Also, just think about it. If you have to put in a bigger bridge or a bigger culvert, you have to have an engineer come design it. There's cost. You have the materials and the labor to put it in. All of it costs more. So whenever we have to go bigger, there's an upfront cost to the municipality. Engineering designs, TP40. We heard about that in the Oyster River. TP40 Rainfall Frequency Atlas. This is the engineering standard that was used by engineers for decades. The data, the stream flow data, ends in 1961. Remember we heard about that stepped that happened in 1970? So all of the rain events and all of the stream flow data that we've had since 1961 is not being calculated in the engineering standard. So everything is being undersized because we are not using the updated data. It's hard to go from those standards. We have engineering standards in place. We don't like to deviate. Engineers are kind of stuck in a mode. Regulations require certain standards. And also FEMA discourages larger culverts. FEMA, when there's a disaster, when you see those culverts blown out, FEMA says, I'll give you money to replace that culvert, but you have to put it in the same size. If you put in a bigger culvert, it's called an improvement, and they won't give you that cost differential. So a lot of towns aren't doing it. Okay, I want the FEMA money, I'll put the same thing in the ground, and off we go. We also have a lot of buildings in the floodplain. This isn't directly related to municipalities, but I wanted you to just see this and think about it. Number one, if we have a lot of floodplain damages, our municipalities are going to have to respond to flooding, evacuations, and all that sort of thing. Big picture, we have over here our commercial stock and our industrial stock is in the floodplain. That's because of our development patterns. Floodplain was flat, it was easy to build on, and a lot of industries located along the river for water power. A lot of reasons why we're there, but we are there. Now, just like the TP40, the floodplain maps are outdated. So this is our building stock in the floodplain, and that doesn't even include the new floodplain data that we should be talking about. So that's an economic issue that we're not going to talk about now, but that's a big picture issue for our municipalities. That could be a loss of revenue in the future. Public health. We don't think about it. And because we're in the Northeast, we're in the Berkshires, we don't have this intense heat day thing going on. But they are the cause of more deaths than earthquakes, floods, tornadoes, lightning, and hurricanes. Well, who'd have thought? But that's nationwide. Here, we don't have that. But we do have certain populations at risk, largely those without air conditioning, those who live in buildings on second or third floors, the elderly, and those with diabetes. So we have risk factors here we have to think about in the future. Temperature increases, we've already talked a little bit about them, but impacts for the human being, we have impacts to people who are already compromised, their systems are compromised, they don't breathe well, their system can't handle the heat. Things that you're going to see, asthma. We already have the highest rates of asthma attacks and ER visits in the country. Asthma will increase because as our growing season gets a little bit wider with our warmer temperatures, plants that produce allergens can proliferate. So not only are we're going to have a little bit more pollen in the air for a longer period of time. Pollen, asthma, closely related. We've got some studies showing that CO2 increases actually increase the toxicity of some plants, like ragweed, which is our major allergen in the fall. Even people who don't have severe allergies have ragweed allergies in the fall, and things like poison ivy. So you're going to see a lot more ER visits for these intense impacts. Dust mites, number one allergen for most people indoors. They're going to be able to flourish because we're going to be a little warmer, a little moister in our homes. We're already seeing ticks, mosquitoes, and bacteria ranges growing because of our warmer temperatures. Here in Berkshire County, our first responders are volunteers, largely. So you've got the small towns with a volunteer fire department, and out of them is usually the volunteer ambulance crew. Berkshire County is aging. So as we have more of an aging population, there's two things. One, we're going to have more ambulance calls. Two, we're not going to have the stock to have the volunteers come from. We already have membership. They can't keep firemen and ambulance crews to the level they need. Now that we're aging and the ambulance guys who are getting older are retiring, we don't have the younger people coming up to take their place. So there's a double whammy there for our first responders. So what we see is that they're already suffering, and we're going to see that more and more. So we're going to have more strains on our municipality budgets because we don't have the first responders. Cooling centers. Most of our towns have not even considered a cooling center. I know Williamstown opened one a couple of years ago. I don't think we have to think about it really too much now, but we still need to think about it. If we start to get those heat days, we're not used to it. Not everybody has air conditioning yet. Municipalities are going to have to think about opening up shelters, something they haven't ever thought about. And again, if we have at-risk populations, our first responders may have to go get them and bring them to the shelter. Zoning. Zoning can help. Most of our towns have floodplain bylaws to either prohibit or limit development in the floodplain to reduce our risk to those buildings and those people in the floodplain. Problem is, as we said before, the floodplain's expanding. Also, outside of the floodplain, we can't control development along our major roadways all that much because we have approval not required. Basically, towns, you are allowed to develop a single residential home almost anywhere, we won't get into the details, but anywhere there's a major roadway. So we have dispersed development still happening. We have more impervious areas still happening, but the towns really can't do that much about it because approval not required. If they meet the frontage, if they meet septic, if they meet a few other things, the town has to give them a building permit. Where we can control development are in zones like business zones, commercial zones. But that's limited. So towns are limited in what they can do through zoning. Even if they do some new zoning things, it takes a two-third vote at annual town meeting for any zoning bylaw change. That's a huge barrier for communities to pass a new bylaw. So it's not easy just to write a new bylaw and pass it. Town meetings can get a little raucous in New England, and if you haven't been to a town meeting, I suggest you go to one because it is democracy at its very base and simple level. And it can get raucous, but it's also eye-opening because everybody has a vote in that room. So town meeting sometimes can discourage zoning. Reality. So we say, towns should just increase taxes. Why can't the DPW just increase its budget? Well, the fact is, the majority of our budget in our towns in Massachusetts, about half of it goes to the school department. And about a third of it, I'm doing that all the time, aren't I? These two here, you have public works and public safety. That's about one-third the size of the school budget. I'm not going to say right, wrong, indifferent. I'm going to show you the reality of how these DPW superintendents, the conditions under which they have to live. And that's why they're doing the gravel, the riprap, putting the culvert in, because they just don't have the budget. Another graph showing that even though the cost of our municipalities continues to rise, state aid does not continue to rise to help our municipalities. So basically, they had to do more with less. And as climate change continues to increase, they're going to have to do more and more with less and less. So it's easy to think, well, why can't they just up the budget? And this is a lot of reasons why. Road projects, Chapter 90 money comes from the state. That's been level funded. It's coming down. It's actually less than level funded in the last couple of years, so that's very difficult. That's a major source of funding for the DPWs. Federal highway aid, if you have a major project, that's in line because federal aid, there's such competition for federal aid. We get way less money for federal aid than we have need for to repave our roads and redo our bridges. So it takes years and sometimes decades to get one stretch of road repaved or a new bridge put in. FEMA funding, again, I talked about how it's a struggle to get them to get to fund your bigger culvert or bridge, and it's easier just to patch. Human health. We don't hear a lot about sheltering. Our first responders and our boards of health are working on it, and they are ready to shelter. But it's still not a big issue because when an event happens, people aren't crowding into our shelters yet. So we're not sure if we're prepared or not. They're doing all the plans, they're doing the preparing, they're getting the equipment, but no one's using them. Even in the storm 2008, most of the shelters in the rural towns were empty or they had one or two people. They didn't have the flood of people they would be expecting. So it sort of discourages them from thinking big plans about sheltering. Mitigation. We're talking mostly today, and it's just one slide about mitigation. We don't always want to think doom and gloom, and we talked about this earlier, doom and gloom. But the fact is, there are ways to mitigate. We all have to think about ways that our municipalities can mitigate the greenhouse gas emissions. Besides having to deal with it, how do we become part of the solution? And the state of Massachusetts has done, we heard from Senator Downing last week, the state of Massachusetts has done a lot. They've put a lot of resources to help municipalities mitigate the greenhouse gas emissions. And that's solar panels on schools. That's becoming a green community where you have access to specific grants to do greenhouse gas reduction projects. Towns that aren't green communities can't get those funds. So you have to be a green community to get those. So there's the incentive. So the state has really done a lot to up their game and get municipalities to think about a different way of reducing energy use. And they're doing it quite a bit. This has got nothing to do with the municipality. This is my last slide. I took this picture. I was hiking up on the Hoosick Range, just which kind of separates Florida and North Adams around the hairpin turn. And this is in late December, 2012. This is a snowshoe hare that turns color. In the summer, well, three seasons of the year, it's brown. And in winter, it turns white. Decades ago, there would have been some snow cover. It might not have been a snowpack, but there would have been snow cover in the woods, and this animal probably would have been camouflaged. Right now, there I am hiking. I'm taking its picture. It's sitting there thinking. It's sitting there, not moving, saying, "You can't see me. If I don't move, you can't see me. I'm a predator, and I can see you, you poor little stupid thing." This is just one example of, not municipality, but I like it, and I like to show this slide. It's got nothing to do with anything. But this is another piece of it about wildlife and the impacts to wildlife. I don't know how this, long-term, how is this species going to survive in Berkshire County? I don't know. This year, it's doing great. But in other years, when we have those years with less snow, this animal is going to struggle to survive. Because if I'm a human being, and I'm not even looking for this poor thing, and I can see it, you know a coyote can see it. So, that's my last slide. And where are we in time? Whew, all right. So, I think that's my last slide. Yes. So, I can take questions, and hopefully I can answer them. Yes?
On the subject of culverts, you talk about wildlife here. There's certain environmental groups are pushing for even bigger, oversized culverts to accommodate wildlife passage through there. How much additional cost does that wildlife passage add to already an increased cost because of the oversized culverts you have to put in?
Okay. So the question was, some conservation groups and wildlife groups are looking to bigger culverts to allow a wide span for not only the stream, but to have a little pathway along the stream so that wildlife can actually use it as a corridor. And the question was, how much more does it cost to give them that extra span? I don't have those. There's actually a study coming out soon. Fish and Game has done a cost study analysis on, I think, a few case studies. I actually asked for that for this presentation, but it's not ready yet. So I think that'll be coming out soon, because we do need to know those cost differentials, because we do see that as a way to not only help the municipality reduce future costs, but also as a way to allow more connections for wildlife to retreat. So some wildlife might need to go north or higher in elevation to survive with our warmer temperatures. They need to migrate to new habitats. A bigger culvert might allow them that corridor to travel in, because typically we have streams and we have some kind of a buffer along the stream that our animals can move along, and they're typically not all that developed. So I don't have the cost estimates for that. That's coming out soon, and I don't know. I'm guessing probably, I don't know where that would come out. I'm sure it's a public document, but where you'd be able to find it real easy, I'm not sure.
Well, I'm sure the environmental groups will be looking for it, too.
They are. There is a group, and to their credit, Massachusetts Department of Transportation, DOT, we always think of them as, you know, guys with pavement and big yellow machines, but they're very interested in this connectivity piece. They want to do bigger culverts for the DPWs and for themselves, because their own roadways are washing out with their undersized culverts. But they are starting to align with the environmental community to do wider culverts to allow wildlife to pass underneath there as well. So they're actually stepping up their game, and DOT is working on this piece now. So luckily the state's involved, and Fish and Game is involved, and between the two of them, hopefully over the next decades, we can systematically begin to prioritize those culverts, and where if we have limited resources, which I'm sure we will, let's prioritize them that can serve both man and animal. Yes.
You mentioned that undersized culverts can result in stormwater getting into sewer systems. Is it simply a matter of more leaky pipes in groundwater infiltration, or is there another path?
So the whole issue with sewer system, the question was about storm drain systems and sewer systems and kind of how they're linked. There's a lot of different things on how sewer gets into the storm drain and vice versa. Sometimes they are separated, but when there's an overflow, they are intentionally linked. Back in the day, decades ago, back before we were strict about treatment, we used to, our rivers used to be used as sort of disposals. So there's a lot of the aging infrastructure. Some of it is pipes cracking, and groundwater flows into it and floods it. There's a lot of different ways. And each line of sewer line or each line of storm drain system is a totally different animal. And to really know what's happening in each one, you have to send a camera up there, a little robotic camera. North Adams has done some of this. Williamstown has done some of it. They've taken cameras, and they're going up those and saying, we know we have high bacterial counts in a storm drain system. Why? And is there an illegal cut into it? So a residence, a toilet is going into the storm drain illegally. Is there a broken pipe? What is that? And you literally have to take the robot with a camera and go up and find each one. And each one is a different problem. So, and it's massive. Because just think of all the pipes and all the connections to every home and all the pipes going underground of all the roads. And just think if you know the chutes, take the chutes in North Adams. Easy to see storm drains. There's holes everywhere. Those are all to a storm drain. And you really have to go up each and every single one to analyze it to figure out how to fix that one particular problem, because you don't know what the problem is. It's underground, you can't see it. So again, that is a very expensive fix just to do the camera work. And then you get a laundry list of, oh, here's the, you know, on this one street, here's the 10 areas I found problems with. Yikes. And North Adams is faced with that right now. That very same thing. They don't have the equipment to go find out all the problems, but then when they find the problems, where's the money to fix them? It's a struggle. It's from our past experiences, decades and 150 years ago when we put them in the ground. Any other questions? Dan.
So it occurs to me that one way that this cost could be approached is, or burden of the cost could be lessened if the road miles that had to be taken care of were fewer, or fewer bridges. Does it ever enter the conversation to reduce the responsibility? Like, oh, we don't need this road, or we're not going to, this municipality, we're not going to take care of this road or bridge anymore, and it's kind of closed down, or whatever?
The question was, basically, can we try to, is there a way to reduce linear miles of road, less things to take care of? So if there's roads that aren't used anymore, can we discontinue them? The fact is, yes, towns can, cities can, and some have. But it's difficult, and because of our dispersed development, even if you have a couple of houses at the end of a road, you've got to maintain that road because that house is already there. So largely, it's the dispersed development that gives us the most trouble because you can't retire the road. You've got to maintain it for that residence. They're already there. You can, some towns have, just for the maintenance burden. There's nobody on this road. It's a dirt road. It goes nowhere. They can discontinue it, and it is cost-effective in the long run. But again, that's not their priority. Your DPW or your town planner, of which only a handful of our towns have, the select board, they don't have the time to sit down there and say, hey, let's do this. So it's again, and it's a decent fix, but it's time-consuming. You have to look through deeds. It's a little more complex than it seems. But some have done it, and they've gotten rid of some roads. But by and large, we have the same roads we've had for decades, for 100 years.
So to follow up on that, so if someone buys property, do they have, is there an explicit right to the maintenance of that road, that road would be maintained in perpetuity? Is that somehow?
If that road, and they have to go through deeds and all sort of things, like how was that road made and who owns it, if it's a legal town road, if it's town owned, yes, they have to maintain it. They may not have to pave it. They don't have to make it a shiny, brandy new road for that new resident, but they have to maintain that roadway so that resident can get in and out and first responders can get in and out. So if it's an approved town road, you're stuck with it.
Are there any other things that a town can do to better cope? You talked about the long-term view, which is do not continue to become part of global warming. You have a crisis solution, which is fix the things that broke and fix them better than they were. But is there anything else that the town can do to reduce its exposure along the lines of discontinuing maintenance, or are there other things it can do?
The question was, you know, what can towns do to try to reduce that burden of trying to just constantly just keep up? And it's rather limited. I mean, retiring roads is complex and isn't done very often. Engineers understand the problem. So the engineering community is stepping up, and the DOT is stepping up, and they're requiring that engineers use data from the earliest data they can find all the way up to the current regime. So we are getting better culverts. We're getting better engineering designs. It's taking time, but we are getting that. Is every engineer on board with that? I don't know. DOT is still not sure about that. DOT has set out guidelines and said you should use a full data set. Don't use TP40 that ends in 61. You can use some of their calculating methodologies, but use a full data set of rain all the way up into the present. I'm not sure it's mandated yet, and I'm not sure everybody in the engineering community is on board with that. So municipalities really need to, when they have an engineer on board, they got to be asking them, what's the data set you're going to do? When you're designing my culvert or my bridge, what's the data set? What's the inputs to your equations? They need to start doing that. And I think DOT is going to be working with the engineers and the DPWs to do that, but that takes time because you sort of have the same standard equations you've used for a long time. Engineers can do that really fast, quick, and cheap when you start asking them to look for other data sets. It costs more for the municipality. So there's sort of a trade-off. And towns are always looking at engine for the any budget that's the lowest budget. Whoever gives me the lowest bid for the engineering and the construction is where I'm going to go. But they do have to think, hey, what are you using for your data sets? That has to happen. Yes?
Thinking about contaminants that are going in the water, this is just a small piece of obviously much bigger picture, but we already sort of have an issue where we use in Massachusetts a huge amount of room salt, which goes in our groundwater and is also killing off a lot of our woods even faster. You know, they're already sort of stretched out. But if you look around, there's a lot of trees that are dying, and that's also because of that. So it's already an issue in the groundwater, but if we're going to have extreme flooding and we're going to have ice storms, which is going to make them want to do more of a status quo, which is to use more of these substances, is anyone sort of in this whole vision including those types of, it's sort of low-hanging fruit in a way. It's like something we could actually do something about.
Yeah.
Is that part of the picture at all?
I can't speak for every municipality, and it's sort of a never-ending cycle. We're going to see more and more because we're going to have more ice storms. And you've seen this year is an anomaly, but, you know, they're out of salt, they're out of their budget, their snowplow removal budget's gone. But the DOT is getting newer equipment that's better calibrated. So if you've ever driven along a road and you see a big plop of salt at the stop sign or at a, you know, where a red light is going and they're still twirling, the equipment's getting better, and there is a lot of training being done for operators to get better equipment, pay attention more when it's a stoplight, stop the thing from twirling and kicking out salt. And they are looking into different salt chemicals to use that are a little bit less active in the environment. But that's an area, that's a very good point. I didn't talk about it, but that's a very good point, and that's going to increase, and that should be included in this. Nice point.
We've come to the end of our time for tonight. Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.